Good morning, everyone. I'm Johnny Ellis, Leader of the Democrats in the Alaska State Senate, and I'm joined by my colleagues this morning, Senator Hollis French, Senator Berta Gardner, and Senator Bill Bulikowski. We appreciate you all being with us here today. We're going to have a few comments from members and then open it up to your questions straight away. So Senator French is going to make some comments about the progress of oil tax issues in this session. Senator French.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Yeah, I just wanted to update you all on the progress of the oil tax bill through the Resources Committee. We have been asked to prepare our amendments to the bill, and we're in the process of doing that, getting our amendments to the Resources Chair, and those should be delivered there later this afternoon. The bill, I mentioned on the floor yesterday, I've been concerned about the inability of committee members to get in a word edgewise to the witnesses. You know, we had 2.5 hours of testimony on Monday from 5 witnesses back to back to back, and there's just very little time for interaction, for questions. And so the 2 points I raised yesterday on the floor, I think, still sort of demand an answer. How many barrels of production, new barrels of production, will we get if we pass this bill? It's a fundamental question. We cannot take action until we have some idea. We're pushing $1 billion a year across the table to the oil industry, or more. If prices go up to $120 a barrel, I think the governor's bill is a $2 billion a year giveaway. And we don't know what we're going to get in exchange. We asked, we were able to ask the AOGA representative at the hearing on Monday how many new barrels we'd get. She said she didn't know. And so you've got the sort of the representative of the industry telling us that we don't know what we're going to get in exchange for $2 billion a year of tax revenue. Same even for investment. We don't know how much more investment we'll get. And that's why I wanted to bring to the attention of the body the fact that, you know, we have achieved really the optimum decline curve that BP said we might achieve if we had an excellent amount of investment. When BP testified in 2006, going back that far, BP said if you really, really craft your tax policy the right way, you'll attract $2 billion a year of capital investment on the North Slope. That'll produce about a 3% decline curve. We've achieved that. The next 3 years on the North Slope, FY14, 15, and 16, we're going to see a 3.3% decline curve. We're just that far away from an optimum state on the North Slope, which I think supports our position that we just need to make some adjustments to ACES and not go for a wholesale giveaway. The last thing I want to bring out is that I have asked for an audit of the auditors. We have not even completed, I think, the first audits of the 2007 tax year when we had half a year of PPT, half a year of ACES. It is a complex undertaking, but here we are 6 years later, about to fundamentally restructure how we do oil taxes in the state, and we don't even know how well the system we have in place is working. And so it just strikes me that we have a lot of data we have to gather. The bill is moving headlong through the process, and I'm concerned about that. And thank you, Johnny.
Thank you, Senator French. I personally appreciate you filing the audit request. Senator Gardner, you were involved in some of the audit requests. We've discussed amongst ourselves how outlandish it is that there have not been completed audits of the ACES system, and we're in the dark. The Parnell administration turned down hundreds or millions and millions of dollars for a new computer system that would track things and do a better job. The audit, I think, is important to figure out why there haven't been audits of the ACES tax years. And do you have any comments on that as well?
Well, I remember the debate when we passed ACES, and actually even earlier for the PPT, and part of our concern at that time was that we would always be outgunned with accountants and auditors and not be able to get the personnel that we needed to audit these more complex net profits tax returns. And we were assured, oh, no, it could be done, it could be done. Well, we are unable as a state even to find and hire a good petroleum economist. We're outsourcing a lot of stuff. And in the TAPS committee, well, I should say every year I come down and ask the Department of Revenue, have we completed any of the ACES audits? And no, we haven't, but they're always just on the verge, almost finished. And, you know, this year, finally, the commissioner recognized on the record that, they could use a few more auditors. But they never say that during the budget time when we could advocate for that. They're fine then.
Ridiculous. Okay, on this point, or Bob?
Thank you, Senator. Bob Takach for Legislative Digest and Laws for the Sea. Senator French, 2 questions. When would be the earliest time that the audits could be completed? Because your request would go through LBA in the normal process, I assume. And second, based on the optimum decline element, do you think the governor's 1 million barrels projection per day is still reasonable?
First question first, second question second. It would take some time to complete an audit of the auditors. It would probably take a year. And so I recognize that in the you know, the political environment we find ourselves, it's unlikely that the system's going to wait until we finish the audit of the auditors before we pass an oil tax bill. I just believe that people need to be cognizant of the fact that we still don't have an in-depth analysis of the tax returns we're getting under ACES, and we're about to make a change. And so I think focusing some light on the deficiencies in what I think may be some deficiencies in the auditing department will help us prepare if we step to a new system, or at least help us, you know, cope with the one we have in place. So I, you know, it's a worthwhile effort, and so I'm going to keep pushing on that. As to the decline curve, I've heard other members of the Resources Committee in committee say that they don't expect to see a million barrels of oil a day going down the pipeline. I think that if we do achieve that, it's going to come from either OCS, which we know doesn't give us much in the way of revenue, but it will at least keep the pipeline alive, or will come with some breakthrough in heavy oil or shale oil. I think those are the two likely places where you could see a substantial increase in the amount of oil going down the pipeline. Whether it's going to come from Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Alpine, I think it's unlikely. I think that, you know, the idea of turning around Prudhoe Bay production, you can flatten the decline curve, but the idea of turning it around, I think, is a little outlandish, and I haven't heard even the – well, we're going to hear from the industry representatives today, and I'll ask them, but I'd be surprised if they express a lot of confidence in that idea.
Senator Wilkowski on this point, then we'll go to Tim and Becky.
Thank you. I think in the oil tax debate, it's important to recognize two distinct areas that we're looking at. Number one is the legacy fields, and number two is the unconventional new areas, which are yet to be which are currently being explored. In my opinion, you're not going to get to a million barrels a day in the legacy fields. You're just not. They've mapped those fields out. The testimony from BP back in 2006 showed best case scenario, you spend $4 billion a year, you're going to get a 3% decline curve. Well, we're there. We're just about there. So you look in the unconventional areas, however, and in the newer conventional areas where Repsol, Pioneer, others are looking, can you get to a million barrels? I think you can, and I think we will. You probably recall Great Bear testified a few years ago that they believe there's a trillion barrels of shale oil up on the North Slope. You can extract probably 6 to 8% of that. That's 60 to 80 billion barrels of oil. It's just an enormous amount of oil. It's a much richer resource than you see almost anywhere in the world. And so they said a million barrels a day within 10 years. They've lowered that expectation down to 600,000 barrels a day, the last I've heard. It's a huge amount of oil from conventional. And ACES works very well for them. It provides capital credit. It provides significant upfront costs for them. The structure we have in place works very well for them.
Okay. Tim?
Tim Bradner, Legislative Digest. Senator Ellis, you made a comment about a computer system, the governor turning down the request. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
I could go back and get the facts for you. Those are easily obtainable. But I remember in the discussion in the last couple of years, Senator Stedman was very keen on providing all the resources necessary to the administration for a better computer system, more auditors, to beef up our ability to not be ignorant and blind in this tax debate as a state, as a sovereign. And there was no enthusiasm and no acceptance and pushback on staffing up and getting better computers and software in place for the state to do a better job. And we asked the question, why wouldn't the sovereign, why wouldn't the state of Alaska want to have the best people and the best computer system and software in place to track these issues with the oil industry? Why would we keep ourselves blind, ignorant, and defenseless against the most staffed up and capable multinationals in the world? Why would we do such a thing? It was a mystery to me, and Senator Stedman remembers the details. Senator Wilkowski. Yeah,
we had testimony that we had auditors literally dealing with millions of sheets of paper trying to do these audits by hand. And we ultimately did put in over $30 million for a computer system. And the governor didn't support that initially. And Senator Stedman, to his credit, did put it in. And it now is in the budget.
It was in the 12 budget?
It was. No, this was a couple years ago.
I just wanted to ask about, Becky Borth, the Associated Press, just wanted to ask about the timeline, because the auditors are allowed 6 years, and we're not quite to that limit yet. So, I mean, has there been talk among the group about changing the requirement, shortening the length of the time? I know that's something that AOGA mentioned during their testimony this past week. It would, even the companies would like a shorter time.
Senator French, you know, my recollection of the ACES debate was that we pushed that out sort of in an abundance of caution, you know, believing that it would never take 6 years to complete an audit, but that we sort of allowed that a length of time so that we didn't lose track of the audits. You know, my recollection is that was something that we were told would, we'll get them done in 2 or 3 years, you know, tops, but, you know, if we have 6 years, then that'll give us a little leeway. So it was never as if we expected the audits to take 6 years. I don't think that's any part of the record. And it's just, you get this huge sort of disconnect between the time that an expenditure happens and the time that you analyze it, and it just seems to lose a lot of the power of analysis and the power of us to shape tax policy based on what's actually happening on the North Slope with expenditures. Just one example. You've heard it almost taken as an article of faith here in the building that somehow spending on the North Slope is being directed to non-production, you know, sort of maintenance-type items. There's no proof of that. That's just become something that people have said over and over. And I hope the next time one of you in the press hears somebody say that, you'll challenge that individual. Because as soon as you challenge them, they fall back and say, well, it's true. We don't have any examples. We don't have any proof. It's just become something people say and it has gone unexamined. That's something you can learn from doing an audit of a return, is where exactly is this money being spent? Are they paving runways with gold, or are they actually spending money on things that produce more oil? My belief, from having spent 8 years on the North Slope, is that those individuals are still pursuing oil with every dollar that they have at their disposal, that ultimately every dollar spent leads to more production. They're not up there for fun. It's not a good place to go hang out. You're there to make oil. That's the whole purpose of the North Slope. And so I think that's just one of the things that we haven't been able to finally analyze and get an answer on, because we don't have the audits done.
Senator Gardner, then Willikowski.
And I remember when House Bill 110 came out, one of the provisions was to limit the time below 6 years, as I recall. I think it was 5 years for audits, and we couldn't claim anything that was in dispute under that. And that was one of my big concerns, that we hadn't completed any audits. How could we possibly cramp ourselves in that way, at least in the short term? It didn't make any sense to me. And in terms of what we know about what's being spent on the North Slope, I share that concern, and in particular as it relates to the state's participation in spending and capital. We're spending, investing ourselves $1 billion a year. We're the biggest single investor on the North Slope, and as a decision maker, I can't tell you with any confidence exactly what we're buying. And I think that it's a matter of public accountability. We should know what our dollars are being spent on. It's a provision in our new oil tax bill, and it's been legislation that I filed separately, too.
Senator Willikowski.
Right. We have no audits done under ACES. We have no idea what our credits are going for. We have no idea whether they're being spent to produce more oil, whether they're being spent on gold-plated runways. We just have no idea. And so as policymakers, we're being asked this year, well, let's just get rid of capital credits. And so, the 20% capital credit. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not. We have no idea to properly analyze that, because we don't know whether or not the money's being used for what it was intended to. And so the problem that you have with, the governor, Representative, or Senator Gardner's right. I mean, when the governor introduced HB 110, he had a provision to cut the statute of limitations down from 6 years. And we said, you can't do that. We haven't even completed a single audit yet. And the problem is, we're talking real money here. Once you go past the statute of limitations time, every day that we miss, we're blowing the statute of limitations. We heard from the former director of oil and gas last year that we were literally blowing the statute of limitations every single day on claims that we had not been audited, and we just didn't know. So we're about to get 6 years under ACES. We haven't had a single audit done yet. We don't know whether or not there are things that are we should be objecting to, whether or not they're things that are being processed as they're intended. And the state is potentially losing millions, if not tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars because of that.
Lisa
Deemer, Anchorage Daily News. On the decline curve, so 3% is still a steady, significant decline. You almost make it sound like, well, that's we're making it. 3% decline, we've made it. Is that your take on it? What would you do about that?
Senator French?
No one likes to see oil decline. No one here at this table, no one in the building. You know, we're all united wanting to see more oil. What is actually achievable? When BP tells you that the maximum investment in the best decline curve you can get out of legacy fields is 3%, then I have to think that's the actual state of affairs. As Senator Wilikowski pointed out, and I pointed out, you will possibly achieve a huge bump from shale oil. That was not on the horizon when BP made those remarks back in 2006. Same thing goes for heavy oil. There's enormous reserves of heavy oil. Someday an engineer will crack the engineering puzzle that is bringing, you know, heavy oil out of the ground. It's tough to do. It costs a lot of money. They'll figure that out. Those two things will turn the decline curve around. But for the time being, we're stuck with Prudhoe, Kuparuk, and Alpine as being the backbone of North Slope production. And those fields are maxed out. And so we either have to look for new fields, or we have to find a way to get heavy oil out of the ground and to actually see some increase in production. ACES takes care of that. I think we've got a good chance of that. But it's important to keep in mind that we're doing very well under the terms set by PP under that tax code we have in place.
Adam, and then back to Becky.
Yeah, Senator Ellis, want to move off oil just for a moment.
Adam, can you give your affiliation for the Gavel to Gavel audience?
Sorry about that. Adam Pinsker with KTUU.
Thank you.
Recently, one of your counterparts in the House introduced a measure to repeal the film production tax credit. What's your response to that?
Well, I haven't had an opportunity to discuss anything with Representative Stoltz. He was not a supporter of that form of economic development in the past. I don't know where he wants to go with it, but the state of Alaska legislature overwhelmingly approved that legislation last year for a 10-year extension of the film and television tax credits. There's an enormous amount of television production and advertising production going on in the state of Alaska. So we're seeing some successes there. There was good support, good bipartisan support for the legislation as an economic development package. Senate Bill 23 last year passed overwhelmingly. But Representative Stoltz appears to be expressing his own personal opinion with legislation, and I hope to discuss it with him sometime in the future. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Last year when we were working on the extension of the film tax credit, some of the testimony that was most impactful to me was that the affiliated businesses, the caterers and cabs and hotels, really appreciated the film tax credit because it brought them business on the shoulder seasons when they were normally pretty much shut down, and all of a sudden they had this resurgence of business that kept them open year-round. And that was impactful to me.
So there's some sort of felt like there's been some sort of trickle down, some sort of.
Oh, clearly there is. Right. Yes.
Okay, back to Becky.
I did have a question. That was my question too. But just to follow up, there was an audit last year that said that the credit program does provide positive benefits, but doesn't pay for itself. And as you know, there's a lot of discussion in this building about where do we make cuts or what can we do without as we're trying to tighten our belt. Why do you believe that this is something worth continuing to pursue? And do you have any concerns, I guess, about, the payoff versus benefit?
Well, these are investments in diversification of the economy and helping small and medium-sized businesses across the state. So we're having success there. If you look at production tax credits across the world, it's a global business for film and television production. And so there's lots of competition. Tax credits in and of themselves do not have a dollar-for-dollar return to the state treasury. In the state of Alaska, we don't have income taxes or a state sales tax. And so economic development in Alaska works differently than it does in most other places. Most other places have, and I'm not advocating for a state income tax or a state sales tax, but most other places are able to recoup the benefit from economic development through taxes to the treasury. Alaska does not operate that way. We are relatively unique in the way that we do economic development and that we achieve our money for the state treasury. So this is a young industry. There was strong bipartisan support just last year. It's not, and it's not prospective, it's retrospective. We only incentivize or invest in these productions as a state, as many other countries and states do, if the work actually occurs in the state of Alaska. It's not like we give tax credits and you can take that money from the state treasury to some other country to produce a film or television. You have to produce in Alaska to benefit from the tax credit, and Alaskan businesses and individuals have to benefit from the jobs and contracts here. So it's retrospective, not prospective, in its effect. And you must work in Alaska to benefit from Alaska. And that's the argument that we're making on oil taxes. If you drill in Alaska, we will be your partner and share enormously in the risk and hopefully the benefits. But don't take our Alaskan money elsewhere in the world to spend it to the benefit of others. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And we all talk about how we want to diversify the economy. This is a bill that diversifies our economy. It creates a whole new sector of jobs, and it has created many jobs. I've heard from many constituents who've gone and worked on films. I think it helps the tourism business. When we have films that are shot in Alaska and people see how amazing Alaska is, I think it helps our tourism businesses as well. And I would just point out, in my community in Anchorage, one film alone, A Big Miracle, created 10,000 bed nights at the Captain Cook. Just an enormous amount of work for that hotel. That's revenue that comes into my community through the bed tax. So I think there are other impacts to the local communities. And Senator Ellis is right. We don't have an income tax. We don't have a sales tax. Nobody's advocating for that. It's just hard to capture that. But it creates jobs and it creates economic development here in Alaska.
Lisa.
Lisa Deemer, Daily News. On the issue of the Senate Finance Subcommittee's meeting in individual legislator offices, I already did something on that, but just wanted to open that up and to see if any of you all have been to any such meetings in an individual office. What was the nature of the discussion? Senator Pete Kelly called it an overview. He declined to call it a meeting, though his memo called it a meeting. Just wondering how it was, if you all went to any of those, what actually transpired.
I have never been to a finance subcommittee meeting in a private office. I've had one-on-one conversations with individuals, individual legislators, but never an overview, never a subcommittee meeting. I think that's improper. I think it's wrong. I think public meetings should be held in public. And during the last 6 years of the bipartisan working group, it was a challenge to schedule committee rooms, but that's the burden of leadership, and people can work the hours that need to be so that public meetings can happen in public spaces where the press and the public are able to access the information, even if it's an overview. You know, Senator Kelly was here in earlier days, when there wasn't a 90-day session limit, and so maybe he feels the rush of business, but it's no excuse to hold public meetings in private places where the public and press would have little knowledge or little access. It's improper. We can do better. I respectfully urge the senator to reconsider his position and have public deliberations and public meetings in public.
I'll just
Senator
say
Wilikowski.
I haven't had a subcommittee meeting yet. I'm on three, and so I haven't been to any yet. Don't plan on going to any.
You don't plan to go to any that are held
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. In private ones, right.
Just in public. Senator Gardner, did you have a comment?
I would just say all my committee meetings have been in public, and if I were asked to go to a private meeting, I would agree with what Senator Ellis said, that it's not appropriate.
Okay. Anything else on that point, Lisa? If not, Becky?
Have any of you been able to look at the governor's permitting bill that he introduced yesterday on the Senate side? I wondered if you had any thoughts on, he mentioned it as a way to help streamline the permitting process and speed things along, and I just wondered if you had any first blush impressions.
You mean SB 59?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I took a look at it this morning, and it's hard to understand. And so I have a lot of questions about it, but I can't give you much more than that. It looked as if it allowed some kind of leasing in areas that are already leased. That's an unusual idea, and so I need some more information on it before I take a position. I noticed that it did get three referrals, and so I think it's going to get looked at pretty carefully. But it's got some language in there that sort of puzzled me about how it works.
I saw a news release on it, and it sort of struck my attention because oil and gas leasing is something that I've been really focused on in the last few years. But I haven't had a chance to really study it yet.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you. Bob Takach, Legislative Digest and Laws for the Sea. Maybe this is too inside baseball, and if it is, I guess you don't really have to answer it, but you don't anyway. But between the discussion you just had on meetings, the recent less than normal referrals of committee, of bills to committees, what do you have to say about the way this session is being run by the new leadership?
Well, the committee referrals were trembling, to say the least. Somebody want to comment on that, who was here Friday?
Yeah, I think it's very alarming. Sorry. I think that people should be paying close attention and being aware that there are sort of efforts to make shortcuts and to shut down or control public participation and process. And I hope Alaskans are paying attention.
Okay. Any other questions before we wrap up? If not, thank you all for being here. We will see you next.
I was just wondering if there's anybody online.
No, he dropped off. Mike Mason, from our friend from Dillingham. Okay, we'll see you guys next time. We appreciate you being here and the folks on Gavel to Gavel. We are adjourned.